order. Apologize for the slight delay. We ended session at about 1:05. We could have all hustled on over here, but there was St. Patrick's Day cake in the retiring room, so we had to do that. I wasn't going to come in front of St. Patrick's Day. So here we are. And one thing I wanted to cover, and oh, we'll wait. We'll do this later. So what we have today is a study of the pollution control exemption, and we have Mr. Folkman and Ms. Volker here to present and make the presentation. So if you want to do that at this time. And welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division, and with me today is Deb Volker. She's the assistant director for the Property Tax Division. She also supervises our State Assessed Property Unit, which has responsibility for doing the valuation of utility and gas and railroad and air flight properties. What we're here to do today is provide you with an information report that was mandated for us to do from last session. The report basically covers the statutory mandate asks us to present information to you to outline and discuss the evaluation process and determining the eligibility of electric generation property that would be eligible for the pollution control exemption. The report also asks us to present information to you or compile information on the location, value, and the tax impact of that property. And the mandate also asks us to provide an assessment of the efficacy of the equipment in reducing pollution. Senator Scoy, after the legislation was passed, also sent a letter to the commissioner asking us to look at a few other things, too. And we included this in the report as well. He asked us to look at the administrative interpretation of the term primarily used for pollution control. It primarily gives.
Excuse me, Mr. Folkman. You don't know. Okay, very good. We can.
Whenever
our
I
cell phones in check. All right, please proceed.
Whenever I see the word primarily, I always think of green acres or agricultural issues too. So it seems to be in other parts of the statute as well. And the other item that Senator Scoy asked us to look at was what equipment would be eligible for both the property pollution control exemption and a utility rate rider. So we've included that into the report as well. The report also includes a brief legislative history and review of the court cases pertaining to pollution control exemption, and includes a section containing responses from both the stakeholders from industry and host communities. We met with them earlier on in the process to let them know what the scope of our report was, get some feedback as to what they thought we should also include. And prior to releasing the report, we sent it out for their response, and they provided some feedback, which we've also included in the report as well. Finally, we also did, in doing the report, we're able to review our own administrative procedures. And we do have some recommendations that we would like to be able to follow to improve both the process and the quality of the information. So in that regard, I think the going through this report and giving that exercise can help improve our process as well. What the report does not do, it does not provide a broader evaluation of the environmental or economic impacts of the pollution control exemption. We felt this was beyond the scope of the report and was beyond our analytical capacity to really undertake that broader initiative. So the report really does not get into those issues. Finally, I'd also like to indicate that here today with us is Myrna Hallbeck from the Pollution Control Agency and Janet Gonzalez from the PUC, who have also made contributions to this report and will be available for any questions or follow-up or information affecting their areas of responsibility. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Deb, and Deb is going to run through and provide a general overview of the report for you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Volker.
Good afternoon. I'll be presenting the Pollution Control Property Tax Exemption Study, as Gordon just discussed. The Pollution Control Report examines the roles of the Minnesota Department of Revenue, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Public Utilities Commission. It outlines the legislative and the legal history of the pollution control exemption. It explains how utilities are valued and how that value is apportioned to a parcel level. And then it also examines the effects of the pollution control exemption on the host community's tax base and the property taxes. The Department of Revenue has a statutory responsibility. However, in reality, we play pretty much a conduit role. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency provides a recommendation to us. When we get an application in at the Department of Revenue, the utilities send it to the Department of Revenue. We basically log it in and then we forward it on over to the Pollution Control Agency. They are actually the ones that look into the application, look at the pollution control equipment, and make the determination of whether the equipment is eligible for the pollution control exemption. And we rely on the Pollution Control Agency for their expertise, because we do not have that expertise in our division. The Public Utilities Commission determines if a utility qualifies for a rate rider, and they also we'll get into more of what they do in a little bit. The Pollution Control Agency reviews the applications, as I said, and they recommend whether or not the equipment is eligible and actually is used for pollution control. One of the questions that we were asked in regards to this report is, what is the efficiency of the pollution control equipment? And they told us that at power plants, the efficiency is usually over 90%. And some of the equipment, such as bag houses, the efficiency is over 99%. Their permits that they issue require testing of the equipment after the start of operation. And then for some larger facilities, such as power plants, the continuous emission monitors are required. The Public Utilities Commission grants base rates as well as rate riders. They handle those. The rate riders allow changes in costs or revenues to be reflected in customer utility rates without going through a full formal rate change process. There are two rate riders through which utilities may collect some of their expenditures that are related to pollution control equipment, and currently two companies, I should say as of January 2010, two companies use those, that's Xcel and Minnesota Power. And we were also asked if we could provide a breakdown of the costs being recovered through rate riders. However, currently that information is not available. We aren't able to break down the exact costs being recovered through the rate riders that really pertain to this pollution control equipment. The report also then goes through, as I mentioned, the legislative history and also past court cases. When statute is unclear, we often, or past court cases may be used, I shouldn't say often, but they may be used for guidance in making administrative interpretations of the law. Decisions that the court makes, however, are based on permits and equipment that's specific to that case, so it's not always applicable to other situations. The courts have previously ruled in some situations that the MPCA and the Department of Revenue have had too narrow of a focus regarding what is exempt. Valuing public utility property, and I'll just go through some of the basics. In the appendix, there's a more detailed explanation of how the property is valued. Minnesota Rules 8100 provides two methods to value utility property. There's what is called a CLD, or a costless depreciation method, as well as a unit value method. The CLD, or costless depreciation method, is used for non-regulated companies like municipal power agencies and co-ops. In payable 2010, 9 of the 14 electric generation utilities received a pollution control exemption. Two of those were valued using the costless depreciation method, and 7 of them used the unit valuation method. Now, if you've looked at the report, or when you do look at it, you'll notice that we're always showing 8 companies. And that's because the data in the report is for payable 2009 as opposed to payable 2010. At the time we're putting the report together, we don't have the information available yet on taxation, on taxes for payable 2010. So all of the statistics in the report are for payable 2009. The CLD, or the costless depreciation method, takes the cost of all equipment that a company has in Minnesota, and then that cost is depreciated by 2.5% per year up to a maximum of 75%. For the unit valuation, a value is established for the entire company. So if the company is located in more than one state, we're looking at the entire thing, and we're establishing a value for that entire company using generally accepted appraisal principles such as the cost and the income approaches. Once we've determined that total system value, then we come up with what's called the Minnesota allocated value. And the Minnesota allocated value is just the value of what the company owns then in Minnesota. From there, we look at what should not be state assessed, basically, and we deduct that from the Minnesota allocated value. Examples of that are locally assessed properties, such as land, office buildings, if they're not part of the plant, and also any exempt value, such as pollution control equipment. That resulting value then, that Minnesota apportionable value, is what is distributed to all the taxing districts in Minnesota. And that is based on cost. So we determine that apportionable value. The companies report to us costs at a parcel level, and then we distribute that total value based on that cost, just a proportion. Now, if you have your reports in front of you, you may want to turn to page 19, table 2. First, we'll look at the utility valuation impacts at a company level. And you'll see there we have the 8 companies listed that received a pollution control exemption in payable 2009. The total Minnesota apportionable value for the 8 companies is shown in column C, and it's $4.3 billion. As you look at columns A and B, you'll notice the unit value, we show the unit value and the Minnesota allocated value, and there are two companies at the bottom, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power and WPPI Energy, that do not show anything, and that is because those are the two companies that are valued using the CLD, the cost-less depreciation method, and in that method, we do not come up with a unit value and a Minnesota allocated value. For the companies where we do a unit valuation, that unit value and the Minnesota allocated value are the same whether we whether pollution control is exempt or whether it's taxable. So you'll look in column C and D and see that pollution control is exempt. E and F show if pollution control were taxable. And so looking in column C, you can see that Alliant Energy Corporation, their apportionable market value is $74.6 million with pollution control exempt, and if it were taxable, it would be $78 million. The largest increases, and we show the increase in column G, so that's just the percentage increase of column E over C. In other words, the apportionable market value with pollution control taxable versus exempt. And the average for the companies is 17.3. Looking at the highest is 72.9 for WPPI Energy and Gas Recovery Systems at 60.2%. And then the smallest increase that we would see is the 2.7% for Otter Tail Power Company. Turning to page 20, we have some of that same information. The apportionable market value with pollution control exempt is in A, and in D is if it were taxable. We've added in here, though, the pollution control equipment cost. An important notation, I guess, is that the cost, if pollution control were taxable, the increase in value would not equal the cost. So we would compare the market value dollar difference in E to the equipment cost in item B. And we see that the equipment cost is $1.5 billion. The market value difference in column E is $748.7 million, or 50.7% of the cost.
Ms. Volker, I missed some of that.
Okay.
What is that graph trying to tell us? Kind of put that
it's
in perspective.
It's just trying to tell you that if, you know, there's a cost, they report to us the cost of the pollution control,
The cost of?
The cost of the pollution control equipment.
Equipment, okay.
Mm-hmm. How much it cost. And if you look at the pollution control equipment cost,
yep.
That does not translate into that dollar amount increase in value. The dollar amount increase in value of pollution control equipment would be taxable is just a percentage in the host
of the actual pollution control equipment cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that last column is the market value as a percent of what the actual equipment would cost.
It's
that right?
The difference in market value, yes. Okay. The additional market value that would come on if pollution control equipment became taxable compared to the cost.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Volkman,
yeah, Mr. Chair, just a little bit more information on that. One of the things we were trying to illustrate with that graph or that chart was that when you determine the value of the pollution control exemption, it's simply not just taking the cost of the equipment. Rather, that cost is an input, as Ms. Volkert has indicated, coming up with the Minnesota apportionable value. That is incorporated into the unit valuation calculation using income and cost factors to determine that cost. And as a result of that methodology, that determines the valuation value exemption of the exemption. It's not just simply taking a dollar for dollar of the cost.
Gotcha. Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to absorb it as we go quickly through this. But as I understand it then, you're under this system, you would use the value using this unit value approach rather than a depreciation approach. You're not looking at this is what their cost was and some of it's older and some of it's newer and you'd adjust it by a depreciation schedule. You're not doing that. You're doing it based on the value that's related to all their holdings in the U.S. And it seems to me it's got to be pretty complicated and pretty intensive to sort of have to value everything that a company owns in the entire country. Is this a really unique Minnesota approach, or this is kind of like what a lot of places do for utilities, or?
Ms. Volkert, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a fairly common, using the unit value is fairly common in the United States, and I guess I can't speak to the world, I'm not sure, but there are many states that use the unit valuation method, and in fact, we send our staff to a conference in Wichita that is industry and government, and then also to some training out in Utah that is for the unit valuation states out west. They have specific training, and that's where we get the training because there are a lot of states that use this method.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, if you're interested in looking at the costs broken out by company further, that is in the appendix on page 47, and there we've listed how it is reported to us broken out by the various equipment that they have. And so that's just in case you're interested in looking further. The ratio of market value to cost, if you look at, again, we're on page 20, table 3, the average for the companies is 50.7. However, if you look there across those 8 companies, you'll notice that gas recovery systems, the second company listed, the percentage is 145.6. The way that we determine how much we deduct from the value for the pollution control equipment is we look at the system value that we have determined as and its relationship to the cost indicator. And for a company like Gas Recovery Systems, which is a small company, not a lot of cost, their income in relationship is higher, then it results in this kind of an impact of an increase in their market value. Or you could look at it the reverse. They've gotten a large decrease in market value because of the exemption. If you look, notice all the other companies range anywhere from 47.2% to 74.9%. So it's just the one company that's looks a little out of whack, but it is correct. Turning to page 26.
Ms. Bokert, I think now we're getting into some of the statistics on how this impacts and creates shifts.
Correct.
And so forth in the various jurisdictions. Okay, very
Correct.
Good.
If we look at Table 6, you'll notice that there are 19 host communities, and a host community is a community that has an electric generation plant that has pollution control equipment exempted.
And this is page 26.
Page 26, correct, Table 6. So we have listed there the 19 host communities. Those communities are in 17 counties. If you look at value and tax impact that's associated with the pollution control exemption, you'll find that 98% of it occurs within and between these host communities. So, you know, we looked at what the impact was outside the host communities, but it's pretty minor compared to what happens within and between the host communities.
And Ms. Booker, if I read right, all 87 counties have at least some of this exempt value.
No, but they will be impacted by it. 17 counties, 19 host communities, have the exempt value located within their boundaries.
Okay.
However, because of that apportionment that we do, it impacts, because it doesn't, it'll impact every property that that company owns.
Gotcha.
And so the companies involved are located in all 87 counties.
Yeah, that's the part I read. But so they don't, not every county would have any of the exempt?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Very good.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Volkman?
The other thing to keep in mind as Deb's going through this analysis, we're looking at the community as a, the overlapping taxing jurisdictions within that community. So if, like, for the city of Becker, it's the combined city rate, county rate, school district. So it's the, it's the combined rate effect we're looking at here. It's just not city government. Just want to make
Thank
sure
you.
You're clear on that.
Very good.
Okay, looking then at Table 6, and if we look statewide, and you'll notice towards the bottom there is a line that's navy blue, it says total, look right below that, and it says statewide. If pollution control was taxable, utility property market value would experience an 8.3% increase. So utility market value with the pollution control exempt is the $8.9 million. With it taxable, it's the $9.6 million, and that translates to an 8.3% increase in utility market value. Mm-hmm. If you look at all taxable market value, it's a 0.1% increase. Now looking at just the host communities, and that's the blue line, we see that there's a 23.5% increase. The utility market value in just the host communities with pollution control exempt is the $3.1 million. With it taxable, it's $3.8 million. And so the percentage change would be 23.5% in utility market value. In all market value, it would be 0.8%. So statewide, it's much smaller. You can see the 8.3 compared to the 23.5.
Mr. Chair, it might also be important to point out the 0.8% for the host community seems relatively low, but a lot of that's being affected because we're also including Minneapolis and St. Paul, and they have very little impact. So that's skewing the statistic a little bit there. Did you?
And I have that on my next slide.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
I jumped ahead. Sorry.
Very good.
I listened to it. Okay, then, on the next slide, and I just repeated the host communities, the 23.5 and the 0.8. Now, host communities, then, excluding Minneapolis and St. Paul, if the pollution control was taxable, the utility property market value would increase 33.4%, and the total taxable market value would increase 2.4%. So you can see that that's much more of a significant increase than it was in looking at the host communities with Minneapolis and St. Paul in it. If pollution control equipment was taxable, and if we'd look at some of the individual host communities there, look at Elk River, it's about halfway down, you'll see that their utility market value would go up 61.1%, and their total market value will go up about 1.4. And then looking at Cohasset, which is the second community, and if you have a handout of the slides, I just would like to point out that the slide is wrong, so you might want to make a change. The Cohasset utility market value would go up 58.4%. The total market value would go up 23.1%. I had a typo there on what I'd sent Paul earlier. So it's still significant. In Becker, the percent change would be 48% for utility property, and in total, it would be 28.7%. So you look at Becker and Cohasset compared to Elk River. Elk River has the highest percentage change in utility market value, but total is only 1.4. So their utility value is not the bulk of their tax base, as it is in some of those other communities. Now going to the tax impact, on the right-hand side of that table, the tax shift onto utility property, if pollution control were taxable, statewide would be 4.8%. So again, if you look down below the blue line, you'll see that the utility tax with pollution control exempt is $247 million. And with it, taxable is $259 million. So it's a 4.8% increase. Host communities in general would be a 13.7% increase, and that ranges from a high, I believe, in it's in Elk River, 43.2%. Cohasset's at 42.6%, and then if you also look at Oak Park Heights, it's at 41.8%. So those would all see significant increases in utility tax. There are four communities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Montgomery, and St. Cloud, where the increase in utility taxes would be less than 0.1%. Moving over to page 27, table 7, we'll look at tax rates. Obviously, if you're adding more value to the tax base, the tax rates will decrease. And looking at table 7, in the blue line at the bottom, page 27, table 7, look at the blue line, the average for the host communities. If pollution control became taxable, there would be a 3% decrease in the average tax rate. It ranges from 14.5% decrease in Becker, 10.4% in Cohasset, 9% decrease in Oak Park Heights, all the way down to 12 communities having a decrease of less than 0.1%. So there are, you know, those a number of communities, there are a few communities where it has a significant decrease, but in the bulk of them, 12 out of the 19, you'd see less than 0.1% decrease in tax rates. Looking at the residential property, and that's on the right side of this same table 7 on page 27. Residential homestead taxes would decrease by 3.2% in the host communities. So again, look down at the blue line, and you'll see the average percent change in tax would be a negative 3.2%. It ranges from a high of a negative, I don't know if you want to say high, of a negative 15.9% in Becker, 10.9% in Cohasset, White Lakes is at 9.4%, Oak Park Heights at 8.6% decrease. And then there would be 11 communities that would see a decrease in their residential property homestead taxes of less than 0.1%. Now hopefully that familiarizes you a little bit with some of the tables in here, so that when you go back, if you're interested in looking at it in more detail, you know, you have a flavor for what type of data is in here.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. If I could maybe just give the members a second to stop drinking from the fire hose here and just catch up just a bit. Just a quick question, because I always struggle with this. The average net tax capacity tax rate, can you explain, or can staff or testifier explain to me what that means, how we calculate that number? I think I'm getting my school finance hat is goofing with me right here, so if you could just please explain that. Thank
Great
you.
Great question. Who would...
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative, the average net tax capacity tax rate, the net tax capacity tax rate is determined by taking the net tax capacity of the property in a district, and the net tax capacity is your market value, your taxable market value times your classification rate equals your net tax capacity. Then you've got your budget, what you need to raise in taxes, and you simply divide your levy amount, what you need to levy, by your net tax capacity, and that gives you your tax rate. So if we're coming up with an average tax rate, what we're doing is we're taking that value for all of these host communities, and we're taking that levy for all these host communities and determining an average.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman?
Representative Garofalo.
Testifier, we are not dealing here with referendum market value. We're not excluding any properties. We are saying when you throw everything into the bucket, all the property valuations, when you times them by all their classification rates, that's how you're getting your net tax capacity.
Ms. Volkert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we're looking at here in the first three columns is the average net tax capacity tax rate. So we're just dealing with net tax capacity-based taxes. The next three columns deal with the referendum tax rate. And so we're coming up with a referendum tax rate there separately. So you can look at both of them separately.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thanks for those questions. Recommendations.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representatives, when we were going through and doing our report, a lot of the research and things for the report, we came up with some administrative areas that were fairly obvious that we could try to make some changes. The first one is currently we are not matching the pollution control applications that we have, and these go back, you know, to the beginning of the exemption, and the orders as well. We're not matching those against the returns we're currently getting. We've been, you know, taking the company's word for it, so to speak. Our files need to be gone through, and currently I believe they're probably mostly in a chronological order, and we have to rearrange them all, get them in order so that we can look at them at a company level. And so we will be working on that as staffing and resources permit, so that we are actually matching up what they're reporting with what we've approved. Makes sense. Like, why haven't we been doing it? But it hasn't been done. Currently, there's no process established to verify that the pollution control equipment is still in use. And so what we're planning on doing is giving a listing each year of the property that the companies are submitting to us to the MPCA. Now, they have other higher priority items to do, but to their ability that they can, with the resources and priorities that they're facing, they will try and establish or try and make sure that the pollution control equipment is still in use. And it probably isn't, I mean, obviously it won't get done every year, but gradually, you know, hope the goal is to have a lot of this property reviewed as they're out there. And then currently the pollution control process, the granting of an exemption, once we send the pollution control application to the MPCA, it takes over a year until we hear back if the property is exempt or not. In the meantime, we have just started, we've got to do something, so we've determined that more of them are approved than not, so we grant the exemption while we're waiting to hear back from the MPCA. To the extent they can, they'll try to make it a higher priority so that we can get some of those responses back earlier. So, are there any other questions?
Any questions? Well, first of all, thank you. And I guess the question I have, and I don't know if it's for you to answer or somebody else, but this became law in 1967. And certainly it was to try to create incentives for pollution control. But I'm sure, and I don't know, but I'm sure a lot of laws have changed that are requiring utilities to do certain things. I guess the question would be, are we providing now a property tax preference for something that's required by law already and that they would need to do without this? Or do you understand my question? I don't know who could answer that, but you know, certainly laws have changed since 67 dealing with pollution and so forth. And so, you know, we get back to when we talk about purposes of things. Is the purpose of this still relevant, still needed? Any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, I will try and take a stab at that. One of the things I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation is that we really didn't take a look at the cost benefits of the pollution control exemption. In this case, if I can rephrase your question, how effective is the exemption in really changing the type of equipment's being used at the different plants? And we just haven't taken a look at that. I mean, it's a legitimate question to some nth degree. At some point, you provide an exemption to change behavior. You get equipment in there to deal with the pollution aspect of it. To what extent, if you remove that exemption, would you also then affect the way in which the type of equipment that's being used at those plants? And we just have not looked at that. Maybe industry can talk to that question a little bit better than I could.
Very good. You know, I look at these host communities, and there's probably five or six that really are maybe somewhat significantly impacted, and the rest not so much. And some of it's somewhat significant. You know, Becker County, it'd be $341 on the property tax statement, or in City of Becker. Cohasset's $231. Any thoughts from the Department of Revenue on something we could do there? I mean, as far as, you know, I know when we had that property tax valuation or class rate change a few years ago, we have this transition aid for that situation. I mean, I'm just wondering, because it does create sometimes a little bit of a conflict there between the host communities and the utilities and trying to bring everyone together. And any thoughts on
Mr. Chair?
Potential policies?
Yes. Let me take another little stab at that. I think there are a number of things that are come together here. You keep in mind the department is sort of playing this role between coming up with a fair, good valuation of the companies, and we're also very cognizant of the tax implications on the host communities. And one of the things that came about from our rule change process, we began in 2003, and it's certainly in my intention with the department as it carries on its role both doing the utility evaluations and providing information to the affected communities to try and make the system as open as possible so at least we get information out. And one of the things I think we may need to improve a little bit more on that side of it is letting host communities and other affected communities know a little bit more in advance in terms of what the valuation implications are, not only of the valuations we're determining, but such things as the pollution control. Mm-hmm. We have established an annual forum, if you will, every fall to have host communities come together and we talk about various issues. We didn't have it this last year because of workload issues, but it's an opportunity to bring in to have the policy issue du jour, if you will, and the pollution control exemption will be one to try and get the industry's perspective as well as the host community's perspective on these things. So there are some things we can do from a public relations and visibility, accountability side. Getting back to the tax implications, yeah, one of the things that the legislature did when it looked at the rule changes, there were some significant changes in how the rule was being applied, the valuation impact, and the legislature passed the transition aid for those most affected communities. There would be a policy call from the legislature on what to do about the pollution control exemption and its impact on the various host communities. And it really does get back to the broader question, and that's something for the legislature to look at, is how effective and meaningful the exemption is to create the pollution control itself. If that's still in play, and if that's a legitimate tax exemption policy to use, and then given the impacts on the various communities, certainly some consideration could be given to how to address that. But we try to stay away from specific levers because if we come in with a class rate change or an age change, there's pros and cons to all of that. So
I appreciate
that. I don't know
that.
If that helps or not, but yeah, it's no, kind of muddled through. But
I appreciate that. Well, thank you to both of you. I know we have Ms. Hallbeck from the MPCA and Ms. Gonzalez from the PUC. Is that correct? Would anyone care to, like Mr. Volkman took a stab at that efficiency one as far as the exemption is, would one of you care to speak to that? Is there someone here from? Ms. Volkert, Mr. Volkman, thank you very much. Yeah. If you'd please state your name and if you have any comments, but more specifically, how efficient is this exemption as far as pollution control? If you could. If you can't, you can't. So please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Myrna Hallbeck. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Pollution Control Agency. And I can't speak directly to how efficient it is, but clearly over time the rules have changed and our permits require more of this equipment. For instance, just for your benefit, this law went into effect in 1967. The federal air quality rules went into effect in 1990. And so some of the equipment will have changed. Our permitting requirements will have changed over time. That doesn't mean necessarily that the power companies haven't been ahead of the game as they've worked with others and have done it. So it isn't just our permits, at least from our perspective, that have folks doing the equipment. There's often money savings for them in how they operate for it. You know, they have their own standards that they apply because they're working across it. So to tell you exactly how effective it is in that, I probably can't do that.
That's very good. So, thank you. Ms. Gonzalez, any additional thoughts on this study?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, tax policy is somewhat apart from what the Public Utilities Commission usually looks at. We generally assume that the taxes paid are a pass-through and a fact of life rather than really looking into tax policy. If you're looking at the pollution control exemption, particularly as Solvik said, a number of laws certainly have changed since 1967, and many of the pollution control equipment that utilities have are required by PCA. There's some that are required by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, obviously. Apparently, some of those are tax exempt. There are a number of other required programs. There have been some Minnesota law changes on the utility rate side of things that have allowed utilities to pass through costs of voluntary pollution control investments that weren't at that time, at least, required by state or federal laws, such as the Xcel's Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Program, fondly known as MERP, that did some of the retrofits on the King plant and converted the Riverside and Highbridge plants to natural gas from coal generation. Those were voluntary. Not that they wouldn't have had to have been done at some point, or some action certainly would have had to have been done at some point to have those plants continue to operate, but they did do it earlier than they needed to, and they weren't doing it in response to specific requirements. But that was more of a rate-making treatment that made that look favorable to them. I'm assuming the tax policy probably also had a role in that, but that was more of a regulatory or a cost recovery policy. I don't know if that's helpful, but I guess I don't have a lot I can say about how effective it is.
Very good. Representative Loeffler, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gonzalez. When you were approving the rate increases related to the conversion of the King plant and the Riverside plant for Xcel, did you take into account these kind of tax exemptions when you were assessing what kind of prospective rate increases to approve? Underlying that big project? Or was this not part of your calculations?
Ms. Gonzalez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, certainly it was in all the calculations that went into how much would this impact rates in the underlying data certainly the tax effect in general would be taken into account in that, in a general sense. And the fact that the pollution control part of the equipment wouldn't be taxed certainly decreased what the overall cost would be if it had existed. But, I mean, since it was a fact of life that it existed, we really didn't do some sort of alternatives analysis that said, what if this tax exemption didn't exist? It was just built into the costs of the project.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, just a different question to the two of you. I'm kind of really on the edge of even understanding what's going on in energy policy, but, you know, let alone tax policy here. But, you know, my understanding of the cap and trade concepts that are getting serious evaluation, they would also influence behavior of utilities as well, and probably much more so than this minor property tax adjustment. Would you agree that that probably would play into us valuing this in the future if any of those steps were to take go forward?
Ms. Holbeck or Ms. Gonzalez, care to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it will come into play. How much it comes into play will be seen on what kind of policy ends up being that way. But the idea of a cap and trade is indeed to move beyond what's just required, and we take advantage of both the knowledge and understanding of the industry to excel and move forward the kind of processes we're doing. So we'd have to wait and see what kind of program is really up there to know the impact of it.
Right. Thank you very much. Who in the audience would like to testify to this report, make comments? We have one, just one. Okay, please come forward. Two. All right. Give you each a couple minutes. I'd like to be done with this portion in about 4 or 5 minutes here. Welcome, and please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Greg Przinski, and I am the city administrator in Becker, Minnesota. And Becker is, as you saw in the report, host to Xcel Energy's Sherco plant. Sherco is a baseload coal plant. Just, again, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the study, and, of course, thank you to the Department of Revenue folks that performed the study. Just a general comment, first of all. We in Becker certainly love being a host community. You know, we host Xcel, and specifically the Sherco power plant actually helps define us who we are as a city. So we take a lot of pride in that. That being said, I just want to make a few comments. The pollution control exemption certainly impacts our city significantly. We believe that the pollution control exemption unfairly places costs on our citizens. We believe that when the plant was sited in our city, the trade-off would be the city would be compensated through property taxes that the facility would pay. However, the pollution control exemption significantly erodes the city's tax base. For example, and again, this was in the study. With the pollution control exemption, the plant would be valued at $549 million. Without the exemption, you'd be looking at another $263 million, which is equivalent to a lower tax rate in Becker. Properties paying 15% less on their tax rate, on their tax bill. The second point I'd like to make, we're also concerned about the future impact of the exemption as additional equipment is added to the value of and old equipment is depreciated and removed from market value. It's my understanding that Xcel Energy will be conducting a large-scale improvement worth hundreds of millions of dollars. It's also my understanding that a significant portion of that construction project will be exempt. I don't have those specific numbers, but it for us in a small city, anything is significant. So I wanted to point that out. And then finally, I just want to comment on the transparency of the process. Becker, along with the other host communities, certainly want to be involved in the process for granting pollution control exemptions. Currently, cities don't receive a notice when there's an application. We want to have the opportunity to raise questions or objections during the process. And given its significant financial impact, we think we should have an active role in that process. So with that, if you have questions, I can certainly answer those. Otherwise, that's all I have.
Mayor, what year did Xcel come to the community?
Xcel, I believe, came to Becker in about 73.
Okay. So you would have known they were going to get the pollution control exemption at that time? Because one of the things you said is you didn't realize, you thought there'd be more property taxes coming, but if it was after 67, hopefully the questions would have been asked, or I don't know exactly how that process works, but you would have known there would have been an exemption there and that you would not have been receiving all the property taxes.
Chair, okay, Representative.
Go ahead.
Let me comment on that real quick. 1967 was 42 years ago, and I can't speak for the folks in Becker at the time. I happen to be born in 67, so
yeah, you barely looked at it.
But I will say this, that being a small community and having a large corporation moving into town, that may have been a detail that was overlooked. I don't know for sure. I suspect that could be part of it.
If I could just clarify, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please state your name.
David Redette, Mayor of the City of Oak Park Heights. The EQB that set up where Sherburne County would have been sited prior to 67. So the siting of the plant and having the plant come into the community, all of that work was done prior to the law change. And the 67 law, just so you understand how unique it is, it was included in the extra special session to override that created the Minnesota sales tax that ultimately was overridden by the veto by the then Governor Levander. Was overridden by the legislature to create the sales tax in Minnesota. That's where this legislation was included. So there's no legislative history. There was never a hearing. So no one, there's no understanding of what the legislative intent was. A distinguished congressman, a retired congressman, Sabo, was the author of the amendment. But I think that in my in my host community prior. Obviously, my plant was under construction in 65. It was cited in 61 as a need. And I think that if we look at this exemption, I worked in manufacturing a drill pipe, and we've had equipment that we added to clean up the air before it went back outside. If we're painting cards at Ford Motor downtown here in St. Paul, or near St. Paul, that pollution control equipment is all paying property taxes because it's all considered part of the building. This special exception that Xcel has, or utilities and some agricultural entities, are to encourage them to clean up the air at the time, at 67, prior to any of these,
okay,
particularly federal law revisions. And so from my plant, and of course, I just want to make sure that, and I'm sorry I wasn't here at the beginning of the testimony, but when we value property, utility property in Minnesota, the Department of Revenue, whether it's got pollution control or not, the entire utility is valued first. They take out the parts that belong to Minnesota, and then they apportion the utility value across all of the utility, Xcel Energy, all the utility properties of Xcel Energy. So power lines have a value because the plant isn't any good without the power lines. So that is helps. So when you think of that, the value of my plant, there's more value in my plant and the pollution control exemption than there is being taxed today on the personal property tax. That's that's how big a number it is in my host community. Now, I know the department didn't take into account that Oak Park Heights actually has fiscal disparities issues with the valuation, so we don't get it all anyway. 40% goes into the pool, and of course, we make Charlene Jetsky's Bloomington Mall of America issue look really different. So I think personally that the exemption actually has outlived its usefulness. I think we should treat XL like all other taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. In order to change the nameplate from 550,000 kilowatt hours and get the federal tax benefits to go up to the 625, which I believe they've got it listed at, so they gain 75,000 kilowatt hours of electricity an hour at the plant, they would have had to comply with the 1972 Clean Air Act and all of its amendments. And all of that would have had to have been put in for them to make any changes.
Very good. I appreciate that. And you're city administrator?
I am city administrator.
Say your name again.
Greg Przinski.
I apologize for calling you a mayor.
So. Well, I appreciate
that.
I certainly don't want to be known as a politician.
He has better job security.
Touche. Very good. Well, thank you both very much. Any questions for these gentlemen here? Representative Garofalo.
For both gentlemen, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Of the property tax revenues your city's taken respectively, do you know how much of your total tax bill is paid by utilities in each of your community? Off the top of your head, approximately.
Mr. Przinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that number is about 78%.
78?
In Becker. I believe that's the number.
So, Mr. Chairman, so...
Representative Garofalo.
So 78, just to make sure we're saying the same thing here, that all the revenue you guys take in, 8 out of every $10 is already coming from the utilities? I know it's going to be high.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Oak Park Heights, we are at about 57%. But before they made the change to the plant, we were down to 26% before they added the new turbine, added the new, replenished the boiler. But I want to point this out. I just want to just
go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Chair, when this plant came to Oak Park Heights, you know, I should bring you the ad, and I'll provide it from XL, because it was controversial. You've probably heard there's a wild and scenic river there today, maybe a court case about a bridge. Actually, the second power plant that would have been at the King site is actually in Becker today because of XL, then NSP, wanted to recognize the value of the river. So it was very controversial. So, you know, if we could use the 200 acres of land there and put on 1 acre a house, I guarantee you we'd have more value there than we would in the power plant. But when the power plant came, there'd be $200 million. The plant isn't worth that much right now on the tax rolls. And when that plant came in and the advertisements in the paper it was the great economic benefit. So when the plant opened in Oak Park Heights in 68, in 1970, when we levied a tax dollar, of course, 97 cents out of every tax dollar was paid for by the power plant. And of course, when we went to tax capacity, when I got on the council in 1997, the tax capacity rate on the plant was 4.6%. Today we're down to 2. That's a big, big change.
Comment. We need to Mr. Brzezinski, and then we need to get responses. I want to do one more thing before we end today. So go ahead,
Mr. Chair, Representative. Just one quick follow up. I just want you to know that Becker's about it's less than 5,000 people. So yeah, that 78% seems like a big number, but we are a small city as well. So I just want to point that out. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And this will be our last testifier. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I have a couple of handouts I'd like to distribute to the committee
very quickly. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to put this issue in some context, and I think that the handouts that are being distributed will help me do that. It's true that the pollution control exemption was applied in 1967. At that time, every business in the state of Minnesota paid personal property tax. Every business in your communities paid personal property tax. In 1973, the personal property tax was repealed. so that now none of your businesses in your communities pay a personal property tax. It was repealed for everyone except utilities. So it's important in this conversation to recall, if we produced shoes, if we produced chemicals, if we produced automobiles in a plant of the same value as our power plants, we would pay that community zero personal property taxes. Because we're a utility, and only because we're a utility, we pay personal property taxes. Just to give you an idea of what that means, if you look at the line graph that I passed out, the lower line indicates the amount of real property tax that we pay, just like every other business in the state of Minnesota. The upper line indicates our total property tax payments to our host communities. That gap between those two lines is the personal property tax that we pay to our host communities that we would not pay if we manufactured anything except electricity. The bar graph is a depiction of really the same information, just to give you sort of a visual. If you took $50 million worth of residential property, they would pay about $470,000 combined in tax. If you took $50 million of any other kind of business, chemicals, shoes, cars, whatever you're making, they would pay $1,460,000. Because we're a utility, and only because we're a utility, we pay $3,460,000 on $50 million worth of property. So when we're and that gap is what's come to be taken as essentially our compensation to the communities for the burden that we impose on them for being there. And so when we talk about removing or the pollution control exemption, what we're really talking about here is, do we want to remove that exemption and increase this burden, or rather increase this payment for the burden? It seems to me that would be a question that you would ask yourself after you had examined what exactly are the costs and the burdens of being a host community and what are the benefits of being a host community. But you wouldn't make that change just because you've decided that some exemption has perhaps lost its usefulness. And let me speak just very briefly on that issue. As Ms. Gonzalez pointed out, XL Energy voluntarily made a conversion to its King plant, spent $1 billion to clean up the emissions from our King plant. Now, I can't tell you what impact the tax exemption on that equipment made on that. But what I can tell you is that we're a business like everybody else, and we look at the dollars coming in and we look at the dollars going out. And if we didn't have that exemption, that change would have been far more expensive, and it would have had to compete with every other thing that we would spend money on. When we sat in this body and over in the Senate several years ago and worked on mercury controls, that was done with an understanding of what those costs would be versus the benefits. And I can't tell you what the impact would have been if we wouldn't have had this exemption, but I can tell you it would have been calculated in. We would have figured out, can we afford this? So when you add costs to doing pollution control, you do discourage utilities from doing voluntary measures. You discourage utilities from cooperatively working on new regulation. You discourage utilities from taking early action. And those are all important things that the state wants us to do. So I offer those thoughts just as part of your consideration of whether the pollution control exemption removal, if that's what's contemplated, is warranted to compensate the communities, and whether it's good policy to encourage utilities to do what you otherwise want us to do. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Evans, okay, one question. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Evans, I always, at least once a session, I have to make sure I say this to you, so this will be the one time I say it this year. Anytime Xcel Energy is looking to bring the burdens of being a host community to Farmington, Minnesota, we are happy to invite you and bring you along. Please come to Farmington. We look forward to the annoyance of all your jobs and economic expansion and growing tax base in the community of Farmington. Come on down. We're looking forward to seeing you. Regarding the other communities, the...
No, wait, go ahead.
Okay. Every year I do it. So
very good. Make your question, please.
Yeah, the question is regarding other communities, Red Wing, Monticello, other communities, approximately what percentage of the city's tax base are you guys supplying at those facilities that Xcel has?
I'm afraid I can't tell you. I don't know.
We have, thank you, Representative Graff. One question, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, mine is a question and a request for further information. As we worked in the Small Business Caucus, there were some people that talked to us about, you know, you need to look at all the benefits and costs of doing business in a state. And they, I heard more than once that the cost of energy in Minnesota is very reasonable. And so that when businesses look at whether to bring their businesses here or to take them away, that is something that needs to play into the equation. So my question to you would be, is do you have any state comparisons on that? And does the pollution control exemption, is that in other states also?
Mr. Evans, you have 15 seconds to answer that.
And I can get that information
later. Which is enough time
more.
To say we'd be happy to gather that information and provide it to members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. And I want to thank everyone who contributed to this discussion. This is a good topic of discussion for property taxes. We have one more area I want to cover, and Mr. Hines, if you would do that. There's a handout right here on the property tax micro data group. Mr. Hines and others work on putting out the property tax simulation every year, and it's not just one person that decides the assumptions and so forth. So, Mr. Hines, if you want to just cover this in just a couple minutes here.
Mr. Chair, the memo in your packets dated March 15th is done by the Property Tax Microdata Group, which is representation from House Research and Fiscal Analysis, Senate Council and Research and Fiscal Analysis, and the Department of Revenue staff. And we get together each year, periodically throughout the year, primarily around time of session, to try to agree on some basic assumptions to govern how we model property tax effects of various proposals. And this was established many years ago in an effort to try to avoid the dueling run phenomenon that was beginning to emerge in the two bodies, at least. And at least to see if we couldn't get some reasonable ground rules in place that we could mostly agree to use at least the same background information on our runs. In bold in that first paragraph, the goal is not to accurately estimate every local government's likely levy, but to establish reasonable estimates of the collective behavior of local governments over the next several years. So the idea is to get a basic set of assumptions that we could live with for sort of the typical types of runs or comparing runs of various types. And it involves trying to come up with estimates of value growths and levy growths. And they're both present their own challenges. But primarily, especially in this current times, the levy projections are very difficult things to deal with. And this memo is just the attempt of this group to lay out the assumptions that we're actually using for this current year. We say that you know, in the past, we always tried to use roughly a three-year growth period of local government levies to sort of key what the assumption would be for the next year. When things were kind of moving normally along, each year was somewhat similar to the year before. Excuse me. What we found is this year, like last year, there's just not really a good comparison year to sort of look at the situation that cities and the state are in. And so it's been difficult to come up with a set of estimates. But that being said, and given that it's there, you know, guesstimates is a better word than estimates maybe for this endeavor is, we decided that the underlying assumption would be primarily to use the 2010 growth rates for 2011 as the baseline assumption for what happens if there's no change. I think most of you have heard about the two-thirds levy back assumption. We kind of
Mr. Hines, I'm going to
too much detail.
Cut you off right now.
All right,
because we have exactly 41 seconds left till 2:30. So, if you have questions on this, if you would talk to the staff here, it's an excellent little memo here that kind of goes into how they do this. But it isn't just pulled out of thin air, but it's very, very important. So, thank you so much. Do I hear a motion to approve of the March 10th minutes? We have a motion to approve the March 10th minutes. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. In the last 10 seconds, I will say next week we're going to hear a number of bills. Not a lot of bills have met the criteria, but we're going to be, you know, there's members here, so we will be hearing bills next week. And with that, we are adjourned.